Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. has come to personify the civil rights movement of the 1960s, but there's an important chapter in civil rights history that's been largely overlooked. It involved African Americans in a hardcore rural county in Alabama and how they transformed that county from a place of white supremacy to the center of the larger civil rights movement. OSU professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries has researched that part of the struggle and recounts the tale in a new book, Bloody Lounge, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. He joins us now to talk about it. Hassan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what is the Black Belt? Because I misunderstood that part of the title when I first picked up the book.
Well, the Black Belt is a region not only in Alabama, but a region of the South that stretches from the tidewater of Virginia all the way to the cotton areas of Texas. And it's an historic area, an area that is really the most fertile parts of many of these Deep South states. It's an area where cotton production really flourished during the antebellum era, during the era of slavery, where large plantations were located that were majority African American. I mean, you know, many of these counties in the Black Belt before the antebellum era and after the Civil War, after the antebellum era, were 60, 70, 80% African American. Large slaveholding places because of the rich, fertile soil. It was a Black Belt in part because of the population, but also because of the rich black soil that was indigenous to the area. And so this Black Belt region was a place of concentration of wealth and of concentration for the African-American population and the source of the out-migration eventually to urban areas during the great migrations of the World War I, World War II period. So it really has a deep historical roots for the African-American story, but also for the larger American and Southern story.
And Lowndes County is located within this Black Belt. What was life like in Lowndes County for African Americans and for whites?
Well, Lowndes County is the buckle of the Alabama Black Belt. In Alabama, the Black Belt includes about 17 counties, really stretching across the middle, the southernmost middle part of Alabama, from the border of Georgia to the border of Mississippi. And Lowndes County is right in the middle, geographically located between Montgomery to the east and Selma to the west. And historically, like much of the Black Belt, it was really representative, large African-American population, overwhelmingly African-American. For much of its history, once it was settled in the 1830s, was 80% African-American. And it had a wide range of economic elements. In other words, the white population, minority population that historically controlled the county for more than 100 years, a minority of 10 to 15% for most of that period, enjoyed extreme wealth based on the labor of African Americans. And then on the other side, you had these the African American population that was mired in poverty. And Lowndes County remains, as much of the Black Belt, one of the poorest regions in the nation.
And this is the setting for this revolution that took place. But it started very small and in almost an innocuous way. They wanted to vote.
Absolutely. Well, there's a longer history. And, you know, it comes into the consciousness of sort of the civil rights movement, those who are aware of the civil rights movement, the civil rights struggle that's occurring nationally, late in the scene. Usually when we think about the civil rights movement or the normative narrative of the civil rights movement, has it ebbing around 64 and 65, 1964 with the Civil Rights Act and then 1965 with the Voting Rights Act. But it's not until 1965 that you have African Americans in this rural county in the middle of Alabama really emerging as a social movement in and of itself, initially around the vote and then expanding. But one of the things that I found as I began to do the research, and I initially zeroed in on 1965 as sort of a starting point, but was how did this happen? How did they organize this movement? And then how and why did they expand beyond merely the vote? And that had me walking back in time And so what initially looked like something emerging almost out of the ether, this revolutionary struggle in a county 80% black that had zero registered black voters in 1965, was when I started to look back is to say, wait a minute, they had always been struggling for a wide range of civil rights and human rights, what I call freedom rights, but only at certain times. And 1965 becomes one of these moments where they're able to organize publicly around the vote because the space finally began to open up. Still dangerous, but the space began to open up.
Okay, a couple of things there. When you say the space began to open up, first of all, were they influenced by the larger civil rights movement that was going on around them?
Well, they yes and no. They had always been. One of the things that we find in these counties where movement activism didn't always take place, particularly after World War II, is an awareness of what's going on around them. So even in Lowndes County, although during the World War II period you have a public silence where African-Americans are not organizing, there's no NAACP chapter as you have in other areas. You don't have veterans marching on the courthouse as you have in other areas in this World War II period. So what we find, though, is that African-Americans there were still very much aware of what was going on, but they made a calculated decision. They understood, and this is one of the untold stories that I uncover here, but really that's about the movement as a whole, is that we have to realize that the South and Jim Crow was extremely violent and that the civil rights movement does not occur everywhere simultaneously at the same time. And that most places, particularly in the rural South and especially in the Black Belt, it was simply too violent to challenge white power openly and publicly.
When you say it was violent, tell me exactly what you're talking about. How violent do you mean?
Well, the title of the book is Bloody Lowndes. And that comes from, that's not something I conjured or made up myself. That's what both African-Americans in Lowndes County, activists in Lowndes County, but then also white residents of the county and outside of it referred to it in the 60s. They called it Bloody Lowndes because the county was so violent. And by the type of violence I'm talking about is a violence that is a holdover from the antebellum period, a violence that is a holdover from slavery. So, you know, we often think about slavery as a benign institution. For some reason, we've forgotten that violence was at the core of maintaining the institution of slavery.
We're talking beatings, shootings, lynchings, what?
Well, before 1865, before emancipation, you know, the value of an African-American was simply wasn't very high. You know, their value was tied to being property. But then after 1865, and they, of course, could be summarily executed and beat, you know, at will. After 1865, that same understanding of the willingness on the part of whites, a sort of slaveholder mentality, to use violence to maintain the exploitation of African-American labor continued. So from 1865 to 1965, you have the same sort of action. So that includes beatings of black laborers. That includes between 1880 and 1945, lynchings, initially public. But then going sort of behind the scenes, these sort of spectacle murders, the regular and routine by the late 40s, the regular and routine beating of African-American workers and pedestrians and people by the local sheriff and the local constables and deputies. So the violence was regular, and it wasn't just something that was limited to a select few white residents. It wasn't just the police or it wasn't just plantation holders. It was the entire community that would rally around the use of violence to maintain the status quo.
And what kinds of actions by African Americans would generate this kind of violence?
Oh, almost anything. It could be both real and perceived violations of the racial status quo of Jim Crow. For example, any challenge to white supremacy could trigger an episode of violence. Whether it was personal or was a challenge to institutional white supremacy. So, you know, by 1901, the Alabama had rewritten the state constitution and disenfranchised African Americans. So any African American after 1901, essentially, who attempted to register to vote would risk their life. It was literally a matter of life and death if you attempted to go down to the courthouse and register to vote.
So if you showed up there, you could wind up dead for having done that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned space. There was a whole set of factors that sort of created the perfect storm of social change in Lowndes County. Talk about what those factors were.
Well, they're both macro factors, larger issues, that things that are occurring beyond Lowndes County, but then also micro factors, things that are occurring in Lowndes County. One of the micro factors is that after World War II, or during the World War II era, many African Americans in Lowndes County begin to migrate. They begin to leave Lowndes County. They go to urban areas in Alabama, urban areas in the South, and eventually migrate up to Detroit. But many of those who leave the county eventually come back. Lowndes County is always home. You don't have everybody who leaves stay away. Many people maintain these connections. And so when they leave, they go to places in these urban areas that give them a little bit more exposure to organizing. Not that they learn suddenly that they have been oppressed. They understood the situation from which they were coming from. But when they leave, they gain a certain amount of organizing experience. One of the main movement leaders in 1965 left the county in the late 40s and goes to Birmingham and works with the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights and Fred Shuttlesworth and works with guarding Martin Luther King. And then he returns to the county and he says, well, we need to do some of the things that they have been doing up there. And he learned some of those organizing techniques. And it takes a while. It's not immediate. But eventually he's able to get the ball rolling. So these micro things begin to happen. And then on a larger scale, the mechanization of agriculture begins to change the nature of labor relations in the county. So white large landowners are still dependent on African-American laborers. But because there are more laborers, they don't have to use the same levels and kinds of violence to maintain control over that African-American labor. And so there's a degree of space that begins to open up in the sense that, well, it's still dangerous. It's still dangerous to challenge power. But instead of being killed immediately, literally within 24 hours, you know, the risk might be stretched out over a week or two. And the reality is that distance in time is really fundamental and allows people to say, you know what, the risk now is definitely worth the reward.
There was also some input from the people in, say, Detroit who maybe had been in unions.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've overlooked and that I was really amazed at when I began to do the research for this is that all of these southern counties, when you tie it into the Great Migration, had diasporas. And so there is a
meaning a dispersal of people from the Alabama population to northern cities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they do it not in random ways. And so the people who migrate out of Lowndes County, Alabama, and central Alabama, move directly north and they settle in Detroit. And so Detroit becomes sort of Lowndes County North. When you think of Chicago, people migrated from Mississippi, from Georgia. People left Georgia and moved up to Detroit, up to New Jersey and New York. So they followed these parallel tracks. And the fact that they recreated community in the North, in these urban areas, allowed them to stay in touch with their folk back home, with their people back home. And so when the movement began to take shape in the mid-1960s, very quickly, African-Americans who had left Lowndes County earlier begin to coalesce, begin to organize themselves in support of what was going on back home.
And they did this in spite of still facing some danger, but they also had some backup at home because there were people who owned their own property, right?
Absolutely. So, I mean, two things are very important. We're thinking about one of the things that we have to remember when we begin to analyze any American history, but particularly African-American history, is that there is a rural and urban divide. And so in the rural South, land ownership was very important. And there were two small pockets of land ownership in the county that provided a small segment of African-Americans an important degree of autonomy, a little bit more space, again, a little bit more space, a little bit more economic independence. So they weren't always as beholden on whites for loans and for their income and for just that little bit of money that allowed you to make a way. And then the same thing in the North. The fact that one of the reasons why people migrated and left the rural South, left Lowndes County, was to earn a decent wage, a livable wage. And it wasn't much more. It wasn't equal to the pay that whites received when they moved to the North, for Detroit, for example, for jobs in defense industries and auto manufacturing. But it was enough that they were able to send a little bit more back home. And so that added to a degree of economic independence that gave people a little bit more wiggle room and helped them decide that now is the time to challenge power.
We're talking to OSU professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries about his new book, Bloody Lounds, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. We'd love to have you join the discussion. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 292-8513 or send an email to openline@wosu.org. This really started to, the movement really started to take shape around voting, registering to vote. How many African Americans were registered to vote in Lowndes County in 1965, where your story begins?
Well, at the beginning of 1965, in this county that's 80% African American, there were precisely zero registered black voters.
Not even one.
Not even one. And there hadn't been one in recent memory. Zero. So political exclusion was absolute. But this is also the time when the Selma movement, the fight for the vote, had really taken center stage. And so African-Americans in the county say, you know what? We have to be a part of this struggle. We have to be a part of this fight. And so when they began to see that there was a little bit more space, that they wouldn't be killed immediately as they went, if they went to the courthouse, then a small group, literally two dozen people or so, begin this campaign. So in March of 1965, where there's zero registered black voters, they say, you know what, knocking on doors, gathering up some friends and family, they go down to the courthouse March 1, 1965, and attempt to register to vote. And every single one is turned away at that moment.
I am still amazed every time you say, because they realized they would not be killed immediately. We're talking serious physical danger every moment, every day.
Every day. I mean, it is living with violence. It is living with racial terrorism. And we hear a lot about terrorism since 9/11. But, you know, it's a critical core component of the African-American experience that we just seem to overlook. And we don't talk about in our discussions. But in these places in the rural South, and it changes a little bit in these urban areas, because then you begin to talk about police violence and living with sort of police terror that has been a part of the African-American experience as well. But this was a daily, everyday type of violence that people lived with and were concerned about. What you're talking about is living with fear. And so what people had to do before they could even make these public steps to challenge power, before they could gather the strength and courage to go down in numbers to the county courthouse and eventually to the jail, because as soon as the first group shows up at the county courthouse to register, the white registrars decide to move the registration place to the county jail.
And why did they do that?
Well, they understood that if there was a place that African Americans feared more than the county courthouse was the county jail. Because that was the last place that you wanted to go. If you talk about fear and violence, you did not want to spend a night. You did not want to knock on the doors of the bloodstained cells that were in the county jail. And so it was living with this fear. And so one of the things that organizers had to do in order to get this movement started was to convince people to conquer their fear, to move to act despite their fear of violence and what might happen.
Because there was a larger objective and they wanted African Americans to finally be able to register to vote. It meant that much to them.
It did. And it wasn't the vote in and of itself, or the vote as an objective, as the sole objective. It was really the vote as a way to open up larger avenues to really transform the lives of ordinary, everyday people in the county. And that was one of the things that organizers on the ground from Lowndes County, but then eventually, we haven't talked about the SNCC organizers, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee organizers led by Stokely Carmichael, who come in, who are really expert organizers, having spent 3 or 4 years in Mississippi and now moving over to Alabama. One of their goals and objectives, one of the things that they understand, is that they just can't go to folk and say, listen, you know, so-and-so who's a sharecropper and tenant farmer working on these white folks' land, you know, just come on down and register to vote. They had to explain what the vote could be translated into, that these day-to-day, daily bread and butter issues of getting a paved roads, getting electricity, getting plumbing into their neighborhoods, getting quality schools, desegregating schools possibly, improving resources, helping farmers gain access to federal loans and the like. That is what the vote held the possibility or that is the possibility that the vote held for African Americans. And so it was part of that pitch of making clear in not abstract ways, but very concrete ways, what the value of the vote was in terms of how it could transform everyday life for African Americans.
But why was it SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that took hold in Lowndes County as opposed to Dr. King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference?
Well, this goes really back to the violence in the county. You know, I had in one of the things that I had to do for in doing the research for the book was oral histories, and it was fantastic. And there was no way to get at to recreate and to get at what happened in this county without interviewing the activists. And clearly, something is in the water down there because folk was still alive, at 70 and 80 and clear of mind and able to share these stories and explain. And one of the things I asked the movement leaders down there was, well, why SNCC? Because SCLC came in first. SCLC and King were right next door in Selma, and they sent a organizers in to talk to the people to see if they could spread the Selma movement into Lowndes County. And I'll never forget what John Hewlett said, who was one of the movement leaders. He said, well, we looked at SCLC, but we knew that this nonviolence thing wouldn't work, that it would only get us killed. We weren't interested in demonstrating. We weren't interested in desegregating restaurants. He said, heck, there's only a few restaurants in the county anyway. It's so poor. He said, but SCLC, but when SNCC came in, when SNCC organizers came through at the end of March 65, after the Selma through Montgomery march had gone through, they came in not talking about nonviolence, but talking about power. They came in not talking about nonviolence, but talking about a willingness to defend yourself if challenged. Not talking about demonstrations, but organizing around the vote to gain control of the courthouse.
And Stokely Carmichael was one of the leaders of SNCC that was there and actually had occasion to demonstrate confronting white hostility with your own determination and willingness to stand up to that.
Absolutely. And the example that you're talking about was a turning point for local leaders. When they were helping, when SNCC first comes in and they're getting on the ground and moving in and out of the county in those first few days that they're there, one of the things that they do is to spread the word about this emerging movement. They said, we're going to have a mass meeting, get the people out. And so Stokely Carmichael and SNCC organizers go to the largest black high school. This is a decade after Brown, but the schools are still 100% segregated. And he shows up and he's giving out flyers to the students about this mass meeting. And then one of the teachers in the school gets a little nervous, a little jittery, and calls the local sheriff. And the sheriff comes in, five carloads of deputies arrive on the scene, and they approach Carmichael and they say, listen, you got to get off this property. You know, what are you doing here? And Carmichael understands that, surrounded by these young people, that this is one of those moments of truth. And he stands up to the police. He says, listen, I have a constitutional right to be here, and I'm not moving. Now, you either have a choice. You can either arrest me or go about your business, because we're not going anywhere. And the police back down. And for many of the students, this was the first time they had ever seen anything like that.
Well, so, and it was probably the first time the police had seen anything like that,
clearly, too. It was the first time, because they don't know what to do. They're dumbfounded. And so they eventually turn around and leave. But it was one of those moments that the leaders of the local movement just emerging look at it and say, okay, these young people, and Stokely Carmichael's 23 years old at the time, these young people are serious. They're not going to be intimidated by the violence in this county. And so after that, SNCC is given a home. One of the local people in the county says, listen, you guys don't need to be men and women, young, don't need to be moving in and out of the county. Here's a Freedom House. And they give them a place to stay. And then as they begin to canvass, people are constantly referring to that incident with the police and say, well, you guys are those civil rights activists that stood up to the police. And Stokely Carmichael, always witty with his words, said, yeah, we had a little bit of trouble with them, but, you know, we straightened things out. And so it was one of those moments that told local people and activists that these young people, these outside organizers, are really about business.
We're talking to OSU Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries about his new book, Bloody Lounge, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. You can join the discussion. 292-8513 is the number to call. Share a recollection of the civil rights movement or share your knowledge about life in the South or send us an email at openline@wosu.org. We're going to take a little break here, but when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. This is Open Line on WOSU 820 Columbus.
Support for WOSU comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses for 154 years. 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
You're listening to Open Line on WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich. It's turning into a beautiful week of weather here. Currently, it's 75 degrees and sunny, expected high of 83 today. Clear skies and a low of 59 tonight, and the sunny skies return tomorrow with a high of 81. The clear skies continue actually through Friday with a bit more heat at the end of the week. If you're not lucky enough to be enjoying the vacation right now, make sure you get out and enjoy the weather. Coming up on Point today at 1, President Obama is in Russia talking nukes and geopolitics. On Point, we'll hear from former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski and more. That's today at 1 here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
WOSU News reports on stories from around the state and in your backyard.
Customers who typically use the Scarborough Boulevard BMV agency to get their state-issued IDs will have to go somewhere else after June 26.
This is one of the first times that we've had this specific instance where we terminated a deputy for these reasons.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU News team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and Classical Music.
Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. We've been talking with OSU Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries about a new book he's written about the civil rights struggle down in Alabama. It's called Bloody Lounge, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt, a remarkable story of how African Americans took the reins and brought a new sense of power to that part of Alabama. Talk about what you were referring to before, people losing jobs, losing their homes, all sacrificed for the larger objective of having some power for African Americans who had been silent and powerless basically all that time up until 1965.
Well, as soon as the movement begins to take root in early 1965 and African Americans beginning this movement around the vote, immediately the white response by whites in power, they understand what's at stake. They understand that if this majority black population gains the vote, that they will eventually be voted out of power. And there is a lot at stake for them. And so immediately we begin to see the reprisals. Immediately, those who attempt to register to vote, who are living on white people's land, white plantation owners' land, are evicted. Movement leaders have their homes shot into. People begin to lose their jobs. People begin to be chased out of the county. And eventually, in August of 65, one of the SNCC volunteers, following the only demonstration that occurs in the county that lasts about 10 minutes before everyone is arrested, is murdered in cold blood by a deputy sheriff, off-duty volunteer deputy sheriff Tom Coleman. Jonathan Daniels is his name. Murdered in cold blood. And so, you know, when we talk about there was fear because of the possibility of violence, but really because of reprisals, it is borne out because violence becomes center, the center again of what's happening or the relationship between whites and power and African Americans who begin to challenge power.
At about this same time, there was television coverage of and newspaper coverage nationally about the civil rights struggle and incidents that were happening, the Selma to Montgomery March and other incidents like that. But your book says there was really no media coverage of the incidents in Lowndes County, with one or two exceptions.
Right. Well, you know, the media is an interesting element in the story of the civil rights movement because the media was drawn to sensational events. The media was drawn to mobilizing events, large marches and public demonstrations. But in these places where it was so violent, where the folk on the ground realized that, you know, we can't even demonstrate publicly or picket a store because we're liable to be killed or shot at or arrested and jailed immediately. And that's exactly what happens. And so there is an absence of these sensational violence. And there's also an absence of white martyrs. We have the one incident of Jonathan Daniels, the SNCC volunteer who was murdered, and that receives a lot of coverage from the press because he's a white martyr. He's a white activist who dies. But there were other African-Americans who are being evicted, whose homes are being shot into, and it receives very little coverage. So the notion that African-American activists purposefully instigate violence in order to get media coverage to sort of bring a new sentiment or to change the moral consciousness of the nation simply isn't borne out in many of these other places where you don't have the opportunity to organize demonstrations or mobilize demonstrations on a large scale. And simply the media, as well as the federal government, isn't interested.
And that refers to the Justice Department?
The Justice Department.
Taking or not taking action with respect to the efforts in Lowndes County.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what did the Justice Department do?
Well, eventually the Justice Department is forced to send federal registrars after the Voting Rights Act down to Lowndes County, in part because they were afraid of what might happen if they didn't. And by what might happen is we've talked so far about how violent the county was and the use of violence on the white side. But another one of the untold aspects of the civil rights movement is the willingness on the part of African Americans to take up arms in defense of their struggle. And what the Justice Department understood very early on, because they were aware of what was going on in the county, is that African Americans there had simply said, we're really not interested in nonviolence. We're going to defend ourselves. This isn't a moral movement. This is a political movement. This is about power. And we understand if we don't defend ourselves, not in a flashy way, not, you know, brandishing guns and walking into the courthouse in a flashy way, but in that quiet way of if you shoot into our home, you better be on the move because we're going to shoot back. And so after the Voting Rights Act, the Justice Department understood that if they didn't send federal registrars down there, African Americans would continue to attempt to register to vote. And eventually there would be, in their own words, the possibility of a race war in this county.
Because they were just simply it was a gun culture. This was an area where people did hunting and they did keep weapons for self-defense. And you do make a distinction between the way whites used firepower versus the way the African Americans used firepower.
Absolutely. I mean, the point that you make is right on target. This was a gun culture. And so when we think about the civil rights movement and we constantly frame it as a nonviolent movement, really nonviolence was something that was introduced to the African American community only recently when we talk about the civil rights era. I mean, that's a very 1950s phenomenon. And for those who embraced nonviolence as a way of life, as opposed to merely a tactic, it took training. It took studying. And we find that only a small segment of African-Americans embrace nonviolence in that way. And so for the vast majority and the absence of these workshops in these rural areas where folk have been living with guns their entire lives, because as one lady said, you know, she kept a gun behind the door because she never knew when dinner was going to run by in this rural culture.
So you had to be ready.
You had to be ready
to bag your dinner.
Exactly. I mean, it's life or death. It's survival. But it was a part of their culture. And so what had to happen is people had to be asked or told to put down their guns. And when SNCC came in, they said, we're not going to tell you to put down your guns. If somebody, you have a right as a human being and as American, as an American, to defend yourself. And that is exactly what they did.
How is somehow that brings to mind the connection which you make between the Black Panther Party and what was happening in Lowndes County? How did that translate? Because the Panthers started in Oakland, California. We're talking about rural Alabama here.
Right. Well, one of the things that happens in Lowndes County, Alabama, when SNCC comes in, Stokely Carmichael comes in, they come in with the idea of creating an independent political party. They had already had the experience in Mississippi with the Democratic Party, in which they had organized disenfranchised black Mississippians to create a political party operating under the umbrella of the larger Democratic Party for recognition as the official party of the state. And this happens in 1964. But the Lyndon Johnson National Democratic Party rejects them. The party of Johnson. They say, listen, we have, even though we know that these white Mississippians aren't going to vote for the party platform, we're still going to support them. And so after that, many within SNCC say, you know what, we can't operate within a Democratic Party. They're just as bankrupt and corrupt as any other, as the national party, as these state parties. And so when we leave Mississippi and move to Alabama, they move in with this idea of creating independent political parties at the local level. And in Lowndes County, Alabama, after this experience of trying to gain power and dealing with these white folk evicting them and the like, after the Voting Rights Act, they say, you know what? We are going to create our own independent political party. And so in beginning of 1965, there's zero registered voters. But by the end of 1965, after this movement for change, you have almost a majority of African-Americans registered to vote, some 2,000 or so, and the creation of this independent political party called the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, LCFO. But in Alabama, because the high rate of illiteracy illiteracy was so high, each political party had to have a ballot symbol. And the ballot symbol for the Democratic Party, the party of George Wallace, was a white rooster. And its symbol and slogan was white supremacy for the right. And so they said, well, that's not the party for us. We got problems with Lyndon Johnson, but we certainly have problems with George Wallace and this white rooster party. So every party had to have a ballot. They create their own party, the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, and they choose as their ballot symbol a snarling Black Panther. And that Panther symbol, once activists outside of the South begin to get wind of this independent political party willing to challenge white power for control of the courthouse, get wind of that, they say, well, man, that's a symbol for us. And Bobby Seale and Huey Newton in Oakland adopted. And many other organizations actually adopt this Black Panther symbol as their symbol of challenging power, of the fierceness and determination of African Americans.
And did they do this with knowledge of what was going on with the people of Lowndes County, or was it just the mystique of this particular symbol?
No, they understood. I mean, they understood Bobby and Huey. They knew what was happening in Lowndes County because organizers, one in particular from Oakland, a fellow by the name of Mark Comfort, had been going back and forth. Many people were going into Lowndes County ahead of the election in 1966, and they were going back and forth and bringing back word and knowledge. And so it wasn't just the symbol that was attractive, but it was what the symbol represented that really resonated with organizers outside of Alabama.
And all of this ultimately was successful for the African-Americans in Lowndes County.
Down the road, not immediately, but down the road. And success has to be defined because there's voting success, there's success in challenging, gaining economic independence and social autonomy. And so those are some of the things that I try to unpack in the book as well.
Okay, let's take a call now. This one is from Josie. Hi, Josie. You're on Open Line. You have a question?
Yeah, just on a side note, I mean, Huey Newton came from Louisiana, so he would definitely have been aware of all the things going on in the South. But I was just curious as far as why do you think there's so much apathy right now, especially in the North, and why there's so little organizing that seems to go on these days as far as the problems that are on right now? I mean, you get a movie like Rosewood or one of the documentaries on PBS, and that seems to raise awareness, and it just dissipates immediately, and people don't seem to be aware of the consistency of the problems that continue today.
Okay, let's let Hassan answer that. And do one thing for me before we get your answer. Say your name for me.
Jesse.
Jesse. Okay, Jesse. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question, Jesse. You know, it's a couple things, because one of this question of apathy, or really the question of how do you get people to organize. One of the things that I discovered or was interested in, what drew me to Lowndes County, is the fact that SNCC, these young people, were master organizers, learning at the feet of Ella Baker, had learned how to organize people. And one of the things that they understood is that you have to meet people where they are. You have to find out what are the issues that people are most concerned about. And it wasn't easy. When we talk about organizing in Lowndes County, or really any other place, rarely did you have more than a handful of the population, 10, 15, 20% maybe, on the front lines organizing for change. And you really can't expect much more than that even today. But that didn't stop them. One of the lessons that we learned out of the civil rights movement is that it doesn't take many people to create significant change. And so the question for today is, or how do you organize people today, is what are the issues that are most important to them at the community level, at the local level? Is it schools? Is it crime? Is it health care? Is it housing? And then creating a movement around that, around practical day-to-day issues that doesn't have to be big, but that can have a significant impact.
All right. Jesse, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
This one is from Charles. Hi, Charles. You're on Open Line. You have a question for Hassan or a comment?
Yeah, three quick questions. First, hello, Charlene, and you're doing a good job and appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yes, ma'am. To the good professor, I have three quick questions. With Stokely Carmichael and SNCC, the first question is, why is it that history does not do him justice in terms of talking about him? And I'm not trying to slight, in no way slight, Dr. King and the nonviolent movement. By no means. Matter of fact, I'm a strong supporter of that. But my question is, why doesn't history talk about Stokely Carmichael and give him proper respect? Second question is, again, Stokely Carmichael, former Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, what prompted the FBI to begin to investigate him? And third question is, why is it that when you look at black Americans who stood up for their rights in terms of taking up arms, that history paints them as, or paints us as, radicals, individuals who are out to murder? And I say that with what went on down there in Lyons County and with the Panthers, who really were saying, look, we got to take up arms to defend ourselves. We're not here trying to take over the government. But if you listen, if you read history, and then if you listen to a lot of folks, particularly those on the right, any African-Americans that says, hey, look, America, you're not living up to the Constitution, and as such, you're not only are you violating our rights, but you're doing it in a way in terms of bringing extreme harm up to including death, and we're not going to allow that to happen. Why is that always why are we always painted as in the light of being hostile, violent individuals? And then if you can relate that to what's going on today with the prison industry, and also where can I get your book?
Okay, right. That's a lot of questions, Charles. We'll try and take them one at a time.
Sure.
Okay. And before I forget, you can, of course, get the book online. Bloody Lounge, you can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It's published by NYU Press, so you can always go to NYU Press.
And that's Bloody Lounge, L-O-W-N-D-E-S.
All right. Now, Charles, these questions are fantastic, and I'll see if I can answer them quickly and in order. The question of Stokely Carmichael, who, of course, in 1969 changes his name to Kwame Ture, but while he's in Lowndes County, he's still known as Stokely Carmichael, and that transition is not just a name change but part of a political radicalization, evolution in his own politics. But he doesn't receive the same coverage. He doesn't receive the same press. He doesn't receive the same treatment, not in the pantheon of notable activists and scholars outside of those who study the movement, in part because, you know, he saw the movement as a struggle for power. He saw what was at stake as a political struggle, and not as a moral struggle. And inherent in that is a critique of America. Inherent in that is a critique of American democracy, a critique of American capitalism, saying that fundamentally it is broken. It does not work. And there has to be something different. It has to be improved or it has to be changed. Well, that's something a little bit more revolutionary than simply the moral critique that people often label or only discuss King in that context. While Martin Luther King was a democratic socialist. I mean, he didn't just see the problems as being moral. He saw a fundamental bankruptcy in American capitalism and democracy. We often don't hear about that. So we've de-radicalized King, but we've always radicalized Carmichael. And because we've portrayed him in that way, there's been a much greater hesitancy to wrap our minds around the type of activism that he did. He was much more about challenging power directly than in ways that were much more pronounced than Martin Luther King at the time.
And was that what prompted the FBI investigation?
That's exactly what prompted the FBI investigation. But now, the FBI wasn't just concerned about Stokely Carmichael and those to the left of Martin Luther King. The FBI had been watching King since before he was in SCLC, since before the Montgomery bus boycott. So the FBI was one of the most inclusive federal agencies in America. They included all people in terms of who they were going to investigate. But they ratchet things up not just following and tracking, but engaging in activities that would undermine the organizing work of African-American radicals, especially after 1966, especially after Carmichael calls for black power, which essentially for him was, we want to do outside of Lowndes County what we've been doing in Lowndes County. And the federal government says, wait a minute, that's pushing things a little bit too far. And so that gets the FBI's attention, even though they had already been watching. But then they begin to say, we have to work extra hard to undermine, not just monitor, but to undermine what's going on with Carmichael and these organizations.
And then what about the portrayal of African-Americans who defend themselves in the way these people did in Lowndes County as radical or hostile or violent people?
Well, we find that, I mean, one of the things that I think is so important about this story in Lowndes County, Alabama, is that we see black power. And this is – Lowndes County is really the birthplace of the black power slogan. It's Carmichael organizing there that gets the ideas behind – the programmatic ideas behind black power. And a central element of that is we have a right to defend ourselves. But too often, that is reduced to violence for the sake of violence. African Americans simply engaged in violence for the sake of destruction. And that was never the case. It was African-Americans turning to violence because they lived in a violent society, whether that was in the rural South and they were dealing with sheriffs or large landowners. They had been living with violence, whether it was African-Americans in Cleveland or Detroit or Newark or New York and Harlem. They had been dealing with violence in the form of the police. And so when African-Americans resorted to self-defense, they were actually resorting to something, and many activists said at the time, was fundamentally American, the right to take up arms in defense of your own livelihood and your own personhood. But often that was merely dismissed then and now as simply being a function of African-Americans being violent just for the sake of violence, being destructive just for the sake of destruction. And that was never the case.
Ultimately, what did the people of Lowndes County achieve for themselves and for the rest of the country?
Well, two things. One of the things that they create that we ought to look back at and take serious is a new kind of democratic politics. They not only created this independent political party, but at the core of this political party was a new kind of politics that I talk about in the book as freedom politics, where they were merging this broad agenda, this broad desire for civil rights and human rights, and merging that with a democratic process of decision-making, a democratic process of choosing elected officials, a democratic process of holding elected officials accountable to the people who elected them to office. And so in rural Alabama, in the height of the civil rights movement, they created a new kind of politics that is still relevant today. That still could be used today, that could mobilize people, get them involved in elections at the grassroots level, and not just mobilize them for one moment for an election, but to educate them and keep them engaged in the political process. And that would also keep our elected officials who are African-American or white or whoever they are accountable to the people who have put them in office to represent them. So in a larger frame, you have this
model for democracy, model for American democracy, a model for a new kind of politics that is so important. But then in Lowndes County, eventually they are able to elect African-American to political power. But then, you know, the question becomes, is political power enough? And so when we look at the movement after the 60s into the 70s and 80s, and this is where I wind up the book, it's really making an assessment of, is political power enough? Is having African-Americans in office enough to fundamentally change the lives of people of color, the lives of the historically disenfranchised, the lives of poor folk? And that question is not only a question that applies to Lowndes County, but to all of America. We have an African-American in the White House today. Is that enough? How do we hold him accountable? How do we put pressure on him and the rest of the government to make effective change? And so that is very much one of the lessons, one of the outcomes of the movement in Lowndes County.
Did they gain the benefits of improved housing, improved schools, greater freedom to move about, to change jobs, economic power? Did they achieve those things?
Some of it, yes. And some of it, sadly, no. And so one of the things that doesn't really change is the economic freedom that you talked about. I mean, Lowndes County is still, and much of the Black Belt, much of the rural Black Belt is still overwhelmingly poor, per capita income, far below the poverty line. And so while this was a political struggle that sought eventually to gain control, to change people's lives and transform their lives by changing the economics of the county, one of the things that we find is that elected officials at the local level don't have the power to fundamentally transform their local economies. And so the county in Lowndes was dependent upon these sort of regional areas, but there wasn't a regional transformation. And in the absence of fundamental economic change, the lived condition of African Americans remained the same. Some things did change. Once you begin to have a Black sheriff, for example, that racial terrorism goes down and it's eliminated. And that's key because people had lived with fear for so long. But some of the other core elements that they had been fighting for continue on and remain unchanged.
You are not from Alabama originally.
No, I am from the great state of New York, from Brooklyn,
okay.
New York.
What was it that led you to this story and to undertake all of this research on what pretty much was an obscure or forgotten aspect of American history and civil rights history?
Well, I had gone down to school in the South, to Morehouse College and then to Duke University. And during the course of my studies, I knew about SNCC and I knew about Stokely Carmichael. And I had heard about the organizing project that they had done in Lowndes County, Alabama. And through my reading and research, I knew they did something down there. I knew they created this independent political party. The question was that fascinated me was, how do you get from zero registered voters 1 year to not just registering a majority of African Americans, but creating this radically independent political party? And I said, the only way I can figure that out is to go down into Alabama and to move down there and talk to the people and do the research in the state archives and at the county courthouse and figure out, really reconstruct the history of this county, but also the history of this movement. And so this young brother from Brooklyn winds up going down into the rural South, the ruralest parts of the rural South, to figure out what happened in this movement that really had such a powerful effect on the African-American movement.
And how did this change your perception of the civil rights movement overall?
I mean, it fundamentally changed. It changes it. Not, I mean, not just for me, and I hope people will see that in the book, that, you know, this movement, to a certain extent, we've been talking about it all wrong. We've been framing it as a nonviolent movement when it wasn't just that. We've been framing it as a moral struggle when it wasn't just that. And we've been framing it in this narrow time frame, sort of 55 to 65, and it was much more expansive. And so I even stopped talking about it as a civil rights movement, but as a freedom rights movement. This combination of African Americans fighting for those fundamental concepts of freedom coming out of slavery, around civil rights and human rights that they had been denied as slaves, because that's what they had been fighting for the century afterward. And when you talk to people, they talk about freedom songs and freedom movement. I mean, it was a freedom rights struggle. And so for me, it's fundamentally changed how I even conceptualize the African-American struggle.
It certainly seems to the book seems to fill in a gap as to how did we get from nonviolent calm, quiet movement to radical, militant, Black Power movement.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that this movement does do is that in the middle, it's really the it's the transition from the civil rights era, as we popularly conceptualize it, to the Black Power era.
I want to thank Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries for talking to us about his book, Bloody Lounge. This has been Open Line. We'll continue in just a few minutes. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus.